Okay, thanks Sebastian for the introduction and the invitation. It's a pleasure to be back. My last visit to PI has been 11 years ago, so I hope my next visit will be a bit sooner. So of course, I assume that everybody in this room, or probably everybody in this room, saw the announcement yesterday, so of course I had to include a picture like this. That's from XKCD, so the added features that you see the size of the solar system. And even though the research that went into making this picture is very different from the research that I want to present today, there's at least one common desire behind both, namely to understand horizons of black holes as thoroughly as possible. So let me start right away with the executive summary. So there are two simple punchlines. The first one is that the Heisenberg algebra, which you know from quantum mechanics, is fundamental not only there, but also in the near horizon description in gravity theories. And I'm very confident about that first statement. And the second statement about which I'm less confident is that black hole microstates in a semi-classical limit can be identified as specific soft hair descendants, at least in three space-time dimensions. Okay, and obviously I'm going to explain both of these statements some detail during this talk. And that's based on work in the past 3 years with a number of people. The epicenters of the collaboration are in Tehran, in Brussels, in Vienna, and in Valdivia. So here's the outline. I'll start with some general reminder, introduction to boundary charges. Then I'm going to focus on our near horizon boundary conditions and discuss them in detail. And then I'll discuss some of the consequences of these boundary conditions, most importantly, the soft Heisenberg hair and implications for black hole entropy. And then I'll provide some generalizations to other theories and other dimensions and give a more general perspective. So in most of this part, I'm going to be talking about 2+1 dimensional Einstein gravity with negative cosmology constant, but many of the features and many of the results that I'm discussing here generalize, and I'll be more precise which of the results have been generalized already and which of them still need generalization. Okay, so let's discuss rather generally with the concept of boundary charges. So let's consider physics with boundaries. In quantum field theory courses, in the first courses that we learn, usually we neglect all boundary terms. We partially integrate at will. And the reason why we can get away with this is because in most QFT applications, we can employ natural boundary conditions, meaning that all the fields and the fluctuations fall off sufficiently fast as we approach the asymptotic boundary, or they even have compact support. But there are some examples in quantum field theories, in gauge theories, for instance, where you can't do this. So one notable exception, for instance, is a quantum Hall effect, where you should impose natural boundary conditions for your fluctuations. And in gravity theories, natural boundary conditions are never applicable because you cannot assume that the metric goes to zero anywhere. So the natural boundary conditions in that case would be very unnatural. So we have to deal with the fact that we need to take into account boundaries. And when I talk about boundaries, I either mean asymptotic boundaries or actual boundaries or just parts of the space-time that for whatever reason we want to cut out. And once we have a gauge or gravity theory in the presence of some actual asymptotic boundary, then we face the concept of asymptotic symmetries. So let me give you a working definition of what I mean by asymptotic symmetries. They consist of all boundary condition preserving gauge transformations, which I'll sometimes abbreviate with this acronym, modulo trivial gauge transformations. So boundary condition preserving gauge transformations are, as the name suggests, all gauge transformations that preserve your boundary conditions. And what trivial gauge transformations are, I'll explain a few slides from now. But it's clear already from this definition that the choice of boundary conditions will crucially determine the actual asymptotic symmetries. So you can have the same bulk theory equipped with different sets of boundary conditions, and then you get different types of asymptotic symmetries. Okay, so let me discuss this in a bit more detail in gravity theories. So let's assume we have some actual asymptotic boundary, and then it's convenient to introduce some radial coordinate, which are denoted by r, in such a way that you approach the boundary as this value of this radial coordinate takes some specific value, rb, which could be infinite. And the xi are then just the remaining coordinates, which often are called boundary coordinates. The left-hand side of that equation contains the metric that is compatible with the boundary conditions you want to impose, and the right-hand side splits into some asymptotic background metric and fluctuations permitted by the boundary conditions. And the boundary condition preserving gauge transformations in this case are generated by all asymptotic killing vectors. So an asymptotic killing vector is a solution of the asymptotic killing equation. So if you act with the Lie variation along this vector fields on this blue metric G, so any metric allowed by the boundary conditions, then on the right-hand side, you either get zero, in which case this is an actual killing vector, or you get something that is of the order of the Laud fluctuations. And whenever that happens, we say this is an asymptotic killing vector. And from this definition, it's already clear that as opposed to actual killing vectors, where in finite dimension you can only have finitely many, you could have infinitely many asymptotic killing vectors. And typically, this asymptotic killing vectors can be expanded radially. You have some leading order term and some subleading terms, and it's generally the leading order term that generates the asymptotic symmetries and the subleading terms which generate the trivial diffeos that are modded out in the asymptotic symmetries. But we're going to be a bit more precise about this, again, a few slides from now. And the definition of the asymptotic symmetry algebra is the Lie bracket quotient algebra of the asymptotic killing vectors modulo trivial diffeomorphisms. So I tried to find the simplest example in gravity that exhibits these features and leads to infinite dimensional asymptotic symmetries. So the simplest example I could come up with was this class of two-dimensional metrics, partially gauge fixed to Eddington-Finkelstein gauge. So there's really very little freedom left. So we have some two-dimensional space-time, which I introduce coordinates r and u. R is again this radial coordinate, and u in this case the only boundary coordinate. And I gauge fix to Eddington-Finkelstein gauge, and the only free component is then the UU component. And I restrict this by demanding that the Ricci scalar tends to zero for large values of r, so I can have a term linear in r, but not higher than linear, so not quadratic or higher order terms. I can have an order one term, and I can have terms that vanish as r goes to zero, r goes to infinity. So this green part here is comprises the Laud fluctuation. So everything in green, so the delta g and the order one term, is allowed to fluctuate. And these boundary conditions are preserved by asymptotic killing vectors of this form. You can check this very easily. So the first part, that you have an arbitrary u-dependent function here, follows basically from this gauge fixing here. Then the fact that you have here that the r derivative of this part has to cancel the u derivative of this part comes from preserving that gauge fixing condition. And then you have another integration function that is also a function of u. So the asymptotic killing vectors in this case are spanned by two arbitrary functions of the boundary coordinate u. So you have infinitely many of them. And the asymptotic symmetry algebra, which I guess you could call BMS2. I don't think something like BMS2 exists yet, but if there is something like it, probably that's it. So if you take the Lie bracket algebra of these asymptotic killing vectors, this is the result that you find. So you see that the functions here combine with first derivatives. And again, this Lie bracket algebra is infinite dimensional, so you have infinitely many of these asymptotic killing vectors. And in some applications, you can further decompose them into modes. So for instance, if you compactify the u direction, you can introduce Fourier modes, and then this algebra takes a familiar looking form. So it splits into an L part generated by the epsilons and a J part generated by the etas. And the L part is just the width algebra, and the J part is some current algebra with a slightly unusual spin, spin zero. Okay, so this is one simple example of infinite dimensional asymptotic symmetries. What happens if we now relax our boundary condition slightly? So let's assume that we drop this strict gauge fixing and allow some order 1 over r terms here, here, and also here. Well, the only thing that changes is that you get order 1 over r contributions in the asymptotic Killing vectors and no change in this asymptotic symmetry algebra. So the dropping the partial gauge fixing does not actually change the asymptotic symmetries. All it does, it switches on trivial diffeomorphisms. Okay, so that was an example of set of boundary conditions. Sorry.
You have to demand the geometry.
You can impose different boundary conditions, sure. Sure, of course. Every choice is a choice. So, I mean.
How do you choose?
Well, that's an excellent question. That's usually physics input. I mean, how do you choose in electrodynamics whether you impose Hirschley or Neumann boundary condition? Depends on the type of physical question you want to ask. So, there's no correct or incorrect set of boundary conditions. There are useful and less useful boundary conditions. And which one you use, well, that depends on the problem you want to describe. I don't think there's a generic.
So what is the problem? Because you could have a bigger symmetry or smaller symmetry.
Sure. But it's not just sometimes, you know, you have the same size of symmetries in the set that you have, in the sense that you have infinite dimensional symmetry algebras, but they're still different. So you can have two just mutually exclusive set of boundary conditions without one of them being bigger than the other.
So usually, yeah, one choice is to take the maximum.
Sure. Yes. That is a choice. Yeah. I'm not sure it's necessarily the best choice.
But it's a yes method. If you get all the soft theorems, you have to.
Sure. I mean, there are cases where going for the maximum may be the best choice. But again, it depends on the questions you want to ask. So, yeah, I mean, as we discussed at some point over lunch, there are examples where if you go for the maximum, then the theory actually becomes inconsistent, despite of the fact that you have finite boundary charges. So there can be some motivations to restrict the allowed boundary conditions so that you don't run into inconsistencies. Yes. Was some other question?
There might be cases where you don't have a unique maximum.
I mean, I sort of agree with the sentiment that it's good to know what is the loosest set of boundary conditions possible. But you know, it's not necessarily the set of boundary conditions you want to impose. It really depends on what you intend to describe.
I mean, any other boundary condition, unless
you have
sub-algebra sometimes. Is that so?
If you have sub-algebra
biggest,
of what? You mean of the biggest?
Yeah. Unless, so you could focus on this.
It doesn't have to be a sub-algebra. It can be something like a Drinfeld Sokolov reduction of the bigger thing. So you don't necessarily get just sub-algebras of the loosest set of boundary conditions as possible asymptotic symmetry algebras.
What's sub-algebra as in field dependent?
Okay, yeah. So anyway, here there was no physical motivation for choosing this. It's just one set of boundary conditions to make the point that you get infinite dimensional asymptotic symmetries. So as I addressed in answering your question, when you change the boundary conditions, you can change the physical spectrum. So it really is always physical input what type of boundary condition you choose. And again, I tried to find the simplest example that demonstrates this, and it's actually surprisingly simple. So if you are not aware of this example, I hope you are amazed by the simplicity. So let's consider quantum mechanics of the free particle on the half-line, so no interactions. And let's consider time-independent Schrödinger equation. And let us look for normalizer bound state solutions with negative energy. And classically, it seems absurd to even ask this question because, I mean, there shouldn't be any bound state. You just have a free particle and then you have a wall at x equal to zero. And okay, you may capture different properties of the wall by imposing different boundary conditions there. But for the usual boundary conditions, so if you employ either Dirichlet boundary conditions at the origin or non-boundary conditions, you find there's no bound state solution, which confirms the classical intuition. However, if you impose Robin boundary conditions, so in a sense a linear combination of these two, so psi plus alpha psi prime at the origin vanishes with some, for completeness, positive alpha, then you find there's exactly one normalizable bound state of this form here, and the energy is given by minus 1 over alpha squared, and you see that bound state is exponentially localized near the origin. So that's an example where, depending on which type of boundary conditions you impose, you get different physical spectra. And the same can happen in gauge theories or gravity theories. Okay, so to now distinguish the asymptotic symmetries from the trivial gauge transformations, there's a standard procedure you can go through. Either you do this in covariant phase space, starting with Noether's second theorem, or you perform a suitable canonical analysis, Hamiltonian analysis in presence of boundaries, and here's some standard references on those approaches. So here I'm going to give a sort of lightning review of the Hamiltonian version of the story. So you construct your canonical gauge generators, which is just some sum of first class constraints. You consider smeared versions of them, so they are integrals over some spatial surface sigma. And then you consider the field variation, so you vary these gauge generators. You get some bulk term, phi are just the canonical coordinates and momenta. But in general, you also get some boundary term, just because the constraints typically contain some derivative terms, like Gauss constraint in Maxwell's theory. And when you have such a boundary term, we say that this gauge generator is not functionally differentiable, and that's problematic for the consistency of the theory. It can lead to a violation of Jacobi's. So somehow you have to get rid of this boundary term, and one simple possibility is to again impose natural boundary conditions. So in that case, all these variations are zero and that boundary term is gone. But I said already that this is not what you want to do in general. In particular, you don't want to do this in gravity. So we need a different way of getting rid of this term. And the simplest way of getting rid of this term is just to get rid of this term. So you just add the offending boundary piece to an improved gauge generator gamma that consists of the original gauge generator plus this boundary piece. And when I say improved gauge generator, I really mean the variation, because at this stage, we only can make a statement about the variation of the gauge generator and the variation of this boundary term. So this delta Q is just exactly this boundary term here, so that the sum of these terms is just the bulk term. So this procedure yields the variation of the so-called canonical boundary charges. So these canonical boundary charges consist of this boundary term. And if you can get rid of the delta on both sides, so if you can functionally integrate this in field space, then you really get canonical boundary charges. If not, then you just get, currents that don't have an interpretation as charges. And once you have these charges, you can classify the gauge transformations into trivial and non-trivial ones. And the trivial gauge transformations are those that are generated by some epsilon whose associated canonical boundary charge vanishes. So now you can classify all your boundary condition preserving transformations into trivial ones and non-trivial ones. And with this, you can canonically realize the asymptotic symmetries. So the canonical gauge generator generates gauge transformations on the phase space via Poisson brackets. And in particular, since also gamma is a function on phase space, you can calculate the gauge variation of this canonical gauge generator. It's just given by the Poisson bracket of gamma with itself. So this leads to the canonical realization of the asymptotic symmetries. And on the constraint surface, gamma is just essentially given by the canonical boundary charges. You get a similar algebra for the canonical boundary charges. And the crucial observation here is that this algebra can have a central extension. So it's possible for the asymptotic symmetries to have a canonical realization that comes with a central term. Perhaps the most famous example of this is the Brown and Noh result, where they analyzed ADS3 gravity and found that the width algebra that you get as asymptotic Killing vector algebra extends to Virasoro algebra when realized canonically. So the canonical realization of the asymptotic symmetries consists of the Poisson or Dirac bracket algebra of the canonical boundary charges. And as a consequence of this, the physical phase space falls into representations of this asymptotic symmetry algebra. And that statement can be useful for holography. So to come back to this Brown and Noh example, what Brown and Noh showed is that ADS3 Einstein gravity with Brown and Noh boundary conditions has a physical phase space that falls into representations of two copies of the Virasoro algebra. And since this is the defining property of the physical phase space of a two-dimensional conformal field theory, that provides a precursor of ADS CFT. Okay, again, some simple example. I'm not claiming it's the simplest one, but it's reasonably simple and it's pertinent to what I'm going to use later. So let's consider Abelian-Chern-Simons on the cylinder. So three-dimensional gauge theory with an abelian connection A. The bulk action consists of this integral over this three form, AUHDA. And I'm assuming that we live topologically on a cylinder. So sigma is a disk, R is just a real line, and K is the Chern-Simons coupling constant. Now, this is a topological quantum field theory, so there is no local physical degree of freedom. And gauge transformations are just the usual abelian gauge transformations. And when you implement the analysis that I've sketched, you find this background independent result for the canonical boundary charges. What do I mean by background independent? I mean that this result is true regardless of what type of boundary conditions you actually impose. Whether or not your boundary conditions are consistent, you only know when you evaluate these charges. So the variation of the charges given by this boundary integral that involves the variation of the connection. And let's now choose the following boundary conditions. Let's assume that as R goes to infinity, the connection is of order unity and has a constant chemical potential. So chemical potential, by this I mean the zero component of the connection, and has some arbitrary phi-dependent function that can fluctuate to order unity. You don't have to assume it depends only on phi. You can also assume it depends on t, but the equations of motion will tell you that it actually doesn't depend on t. And these boundary conditions are preserved by gauge potentials of that form. Epsilon is some function of phi plus subleading terms. So now you can insert into, now you can derive what the asymptotic symmetry algebra is. These Poisson brackets are given by the variation of the charges. And if you insert this result for epsilon into that variation here using the standard form of abelian gauge transformations, you end up with this result on the right-hand side. So in this case, the asymptotic symmetry algebra is abelian up to a central term. And if you introduce Fourier modes, you just get a U1 current algebra with level k. And one of the reasons I'm displaying this in detail is because we're going to encounter precisely this type of algebra in our near horizon discussion a bit later on. Okay, as a final part of the introductory part, let me address edge states. So if we change the boundary charges, then we generally change the physical state. And that means the boundary charges, when they're non-trivial, can generate so-called edge states. And let me give you a concrete example. let's reconsider this abelian Gensimon's example. I've now converted the Poisson brackets into commutators. So in terms of those, the asymptotic symmetry algebra is this U1 current algebra. And now let's define the usual high state vacuum. So defined by the annihilation of all Jn with non-negative index n. And descendants of the vacuum are then examples of edge states. So you can label these edge states by a collection of integer numbers, and you generate them by acting with creation operators on the vacuum. So for instance, the edge state labeled by the numbers 1, 1, and 42 is given by j minus 1 squared, j minus 42 acting on the vacuum. And that means, so this is a concrete example of a theory that has no local physical degrees of freedom, but nevertheless has physical states, namely edge states. And perhaps this type of theories lead to the cleanest examples of holography, because the theory is sort of manifestly holographic from the very beginning. Okay, are there any questions on this basic aspects? Okay, so let me now come to our near horizon boundary conditions. So there are various different motivations you can have for doing such a thing. The main idea is to impose the existence of a non-extremal horizon as a boundary condition on the state space. So one motivation for this could be that if you want to ask conditional questions, like given a black hole, what are the probabilities for some scattering process, then you may want to impose boundary conditions that ensure that this premise here is actually met, so that you actually do have a black hole or do have some geometry that exhibits a horizon. Another quite different motivation comes from our desire to understand the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, at least in the semi-classical limit. And some questions you can ask is, why is there only semi-classical input for this entropy? What are the microstates in the semi-classical input, in the semi-classical limit? Can we semi-classically construct them? And if so, does the counting reproduce the leading and subleading contribution to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy? Okay, so let's now start by postulating some near horizon boundary conditions. So I have color coded them. So we assume we can do a Rindle approximation as we come close to the horizon. So we're imposing boundary condition on the stretched horizon that is arbitrarily close to the actual horizon. So we have this Rindler expansion. So as r goes to zero, we encounter Rindler horizon with some surface gravity kappa. And then we have a metric transversal to the horizon and some additional, well, higher order terms in R or rotation terms that I'm not going to write down here. And so far, I haven't specified how or if omega or kappa are allowed to fluctuate. And specifying this is an important part of specifying the theory and then fixing the boundary conditions. So the main assumption that goes into these boundary conditions is that surface gravity is assumed to be state independent. It's quite non-trivial. Well, it's a non-trivial assumption. It's not clear that you should make this choice, but it's a possible choice, and it's the choice that we're going to make. I'm going to comment on some consequences of this choice on the next slide. The other assumption you have to make is whether or not you allow fluctuations of this metric transversal to the horizon, and we're going to assume that it's allowed to be state dependent. So, you know, if you speak holography in holographic slang, it means that kappa is essentially a chemical potential or a source, and omega is like a VEF or a normalizable mode, whereas kappa is a non-normalizable mode. And the remaining terms are actually fixed by consistency of the canonical boundary charges. So once we make these choices, everything else is fixed up to trivial gauge transformations. Okay, so these are our boundary conditions, and let's study some consequences. So the first one is, as my colleagues in Chile like to call them, you can deform the black holes into black flowers. So you can, you know, just perform some area-preserving shear deformation, and then you make a diffy of the round S1 into non-round S1. Of course, this is just a diffy, so you have to ask yourself, is this a trivial or a non-trivial diffy?
You make this choice, but there are other choices.
True.
It's kind of a simple choice, but you make it
I'm going to explain, actually not on this slide, but on the next slide, why we choose specifically surface gravity as constant.
Yeah, we also choose the rotation coefficient to vanish, choose the
RR component. No, the rotation coefficient is not vanishing. I just didn't write it down.
I mean the
Or what do you mean?
The,
yeah, yeah.
The other component of the metric.
Exactly, so this is non-zero. This is not zero.
Okay.
So. From now on, I'm going to restrict for the most of the rest of the talk to three dimensions. So in three dimensions, we can be a bit more explicit. In particular, I'm writing down now this shift part, so the rotation term. And we're going to assume that we're in a co-rotating frame, so there's no order one piece in the shift part, but just an order r squared piece.
And you also assume that the dt dr part.
Yeah, but that can be achieved in this case by a small gauge transformation.
But the reason that the gauge transformation wouldn't vanish at the horizon.
Yeah, exactly.
And the horizon is part of the boundary that you are.
There are different boundary conditions. We choose these.
Yeah.
There are different choices possible. Yes. Okay. So this function gamma here is allowed to fluctuate to order unity, omega as well. And the interpretation of gamma is just maps from this one to some Fourier excited this one. And whether or not this is trivial, well, the answer is provided by the boundary charges. And it turns out that both gamma and omega are non-trivial. So the canonical boundary charges are just given by linear combinations of gamma and omega. And again, well, I simplified here a lot, but you don't have to assume that this is time independent. You get this as a consequence of the, if you want, holographic water entities or onshore relations. And they just tell you that if surface gravity is fixed to be constant, then gamma and omega have to be time independent. Okay, so that means that these excitations that I've shown on the previous picture are actually physical excitations. So that explains finally the last word in the title, namely hair. You can think of gamma and omega if you want this hair of the black hole. So there are different choices for gamma and omega correspond to different physical states. If you look at the near horizon symmetries, you find, much to our surprise, that it's a very simple one, namely U1 current algebra. So it's precisely, and you get two copies of them. So it's precisely the type of algebra that we saw in the abelian Chern-Simons example. And it's simpler than what you usually get in three-dimensional gravity theories. So it's simpler than BMS or Virasoro or warped conformal algebra. And by a simple change of basis, you see that this is isomorphic to infinitely many Heisenberg algebras with some additional center. So in particular, this quantity P0, which is a sum of the zero mode charges, J0 plus plus J0 minus, that commutes with all the generators. And this is going to be important physically. Yes?
What is the DVO actually look like? The boundary that this charge is generating, is it like normal to the boundary or?
So you have super translations and you have area preserving shear deformations. That's the geometric interpretation of these different morphisms.
For the shear deformations, like the vector at the boundary, is it tangent to the boundary or normal?
So the shear deformations are precisely these maps of the S1 to Fourier excited S1, the ones that I displayed on the previous slide.
So that means it's tangent to the circles?
It's just a diffy of the S1.
Oh, okay, maybe in circle and
Yeah. It's just the first one.
This is 2 plus 1? Or?
Yes.
So a circle is a circle, right? You can't change its shape. Does it have something to do with its time dependence? Or?
Well, you can Fourier expand it.
What does it mean? Symmetric. I think that's
this.
Counting diffs.
Yes.
I understand the mathematical
procedure. So geometrically, this is what it means. If you look at these pictures, that's the.
What is that? The question is that to change in the embedding?
Sorry?
Is it a change of the embedding?
Well.
Yes or no?
It's a diff of S1. That's all it is.
It's just diff of S1?
Yes.
So it's tangent, it's not a change of the embedding.
So it's tangent, so it is tangent.
Yeah, so the other. Is it tangent or normal? That's the only question. It's not a tricky question.
Sure.
It's... Are you changing the embedding or
no? No, I'm just performing a diffeomorphism of the S1. That's all.
It's tangent.
But are you able to describe it as a diffeo of the 3D space? Like, what it looks like? That's
sure, sure. You can construct asymptotic Killing vectors, and you can sort of get all the subleading terms, and then you know what is the vector field that generates this diffeomorphism. Yeah.
But then the question is, once you do that, is it tangent or normal to the boundary?
Any restricts?
Is it E over D phi?
Sorry.
Is it like E over D phi as a vector field?
Sure. Yeah. With arbitrary. Phi-dependent coefficients. Again, it's diff as one. I don't think there's anything I can add to this, adds anything to the statement I'm making. So it's a map of the S1
you,
to the S1.
Also on the diff S1 into diff of all three of the full metric. So diff S1 is diff S1, it's fine. But then when acting on the 4D metric.
So I've explicitly written down the diff for you. So that's what it is.
So it's tangent.
Okay. Good. So what are the unique features of these boundary conditions? The first one is that all states allowed by the boundary conditions have the same temperature. So this is quite unusual. So by contrast, in typically asymptotically ADS of flat Swiss boundary conditions, allowed black hole states at different masses have different temperatures. So that means all states in that theory have always the same temperature. Another remarkable feature is that all states allowed by the boundary conditions are regular. So that's also not what happens usually. So in particular, they don't have conical singularities at the horizon in the Euclidean formulation. So usually when you prescribe some temperature, then not all states in the theory that are compatible with your boundary conditions are free from conical singularities. Usually a unique black hole state, or at least a discrete set of black hole states, is picked. Whereas in these boundary conditions, all states are regular at the horizon and don't have conical singularities. This is a bit more technical, but there's a non-trivial reducibility parameter. So in this case, it's just a Killing vector. By contrast, for any other known non-trivial boundary conditions, there's no vector field that is Killing for all geometries allowed by the boundary conditions. This is also a more technical feature, so that's, I guess, only of interest for people more familiar with the Chan-Simons formulation. So in the Chan-Simons formulation of 3D gravity, a simple way to represent our boundary conditions is to go into diagonal gauge so that this group element small a, or this connection small a, contains only the Cartan subalgebra generator L0. And the radial dependence, as usual, is captured by this group element B that depends on the radius but is state independent. And that sort of explains why you get the same result as in abelian Chan-Simons for the asymptotic symmetries, because since L0 commutes with itself, you have abelianized the essential part of the connection, so you just get U1 current algebras. In fact, these boundary conditions are essentially identical to the ones that we discussed in the abelian Chan-Simons case. And finally, another feature of this boundary condition is that they lead to soft Heisenberg here, which I'm going to explain on the next slides. Okay, so let's discuss now some consequences of these boundary conditions, and the first one is going to be soft Heisenberg here, so that finally I explain all the three words in the title. So these so-called black flower excitations, or hair of black holes, are algebraically generated as excitations, so as descendants of the black hole. So a black flower is just a black hole state on which you act with an arbitrary combination of creation operators. And it's then an interesting question to ask, what is the energy of such excitations? Typically, when you generate descendants of a state, you raise the energy. So for instance, if you have some state in ADS3 gravity with Brown and no boundary conditions, like a BDZ black hole, you act on it with some Virasoro generators, L minus N, then you get a Virasoro descendant of that black hole, but that has a higher energy than the original black hole. So to answer this question, we need to find out what is the Hamiltonian, which we call near horizon Hamiltonian. So that's the boundary charge associated with unit time translations. So it's the charge associated with ET. And that, up to a state independent factor, kappa, is just given by the zero mode charge P0. But remember that P0, which was the sum of J0 plus plus J0 minus, that this P0 commutes with all the generators Jn plus minus. So that means that the H eigenvalue of any black flower is equal to the H eigenvalue of the black hole from which it descends. So it means that the black flower excitations actually do not change the energy of the black hole. So all the black flower excitations, or all the black flowers, have the same energy as the original black hole you started with. So these black flower excitations have precisely the property of soft hair in the sense of Hawking-Perrin-Strominger. They constitute non-trivial physical excitations because there are non-trivial boundary charges associated with them, but they don't have any energy.
Would you say the black flower and the black hole represent the same space-time?
I would not say that they represent the same physical state. They are, of course, diffeomorphic to each other, but, you know, the point is that the diffeomorphisms that you use are not small diffeomorphisms. So they change the physical state. Geometrically, they are, you know, equivalent in the sense that they are diffeomorphic. Okay, and because this soft hair falls into representations of infinite copies of the Heisenberg algebra, we call it soft Heisenberg hair. Okay, so what can we do with this soft Heisenberg here? One thing you can do is you can express the entropy in terms of the near horizon charges and thereby find a new and very simple entropy formula. It's just, the entropy is just given by 2 pi times the sum of the zero mode charges, J0 plus plus J0 minus, or this quantity P0 that I introduced. And as a consequence, you get a very simple near horizon first law. So,
you get that by counting,
No, this is at the moment is just a macroscopic formula. So you get this basically by calculating the macroscopic free energy.
Not that you have space.
You mean can we actually count this? Yeah, I'll come to that. Yeah. So the reason why this near horizon first law is so simple is because kappa is state independent, so we can it through this variation, and then you just get T delta S is delta H with the usual Hawking unruh temperature. So here it's quite crucial that kappa is state independent. Now, that formula is rather universal, so it applies even in cases where Bekenstein-Hawking does not apply, but when Bekenstein-Hawking applies, this is just the Bekenstein-Hawking law. So in particular, it applies to higher derivative theories, also to higher spin theories, and it also works in higher dimensional theories, regardless of whether you are in ADS, De Sitter flat space, warped ADS, or We haven't studied other examples yet, but it works for all these examples. That entropy, in a sense, is in Cardi-like form. So the Cardi formula expresses the entropy, well, in the case of CFD, as a square root, as a sum of square root of zero mode charges. Here, by contrast, we have just sum of the charges, so it's a bit simpler than the original Cardi formula because it's linear in the charges. And, well, the question that was already raised is, can we understand this entropy law microscopically? So, by the way, how much time?
Well, it's like 50 minutes, but you can go a bit longer without leaving any questions.
Okay. Okay, so let's come back to these questions. Given our soft Heisenberg here, now let's attack them. Why is there only semi-classical input for the entropy? What are the microstates? Can we semi-classically construct them? And if so, does the counting reproduce the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy? Regarding the first and the third point, you know, you may expect a decoupling of scale so that description of the microstates does not need info about the UV completion, but rather only semi-classical input, so some Bohr-like quantization rules, but not the full UV completion, at least for large black holes that are sufficiently away from extremality. The evidence for this is the universality of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy law. So let's just assume that this is possible. So let's assume it's possible to construct microstates for large black holes semi-classically using soft excitations. And I mean, it's a very non-trivial assumption. It's not clear at this stage whether this is possible. So then you immediately encounter two obstacles. The first one is too much information. Precisely because soft excitations are soft, so they don't contain any energy, there's no upper bound on the soft excitation. So you can equip a black hole with an arbitrary amount of soft hair. So if you have this fantasy that soft hair has anything to do with the entropy of black holes, then you would conclude that this stage, the naively, the entropy is going to be infinite. So a possible resolution is to provide a cutoff on the soft hair spectrum, but of course you have to be careful here. I mean, if you introduce a cutoff by hand, then of course you get any result that you want, but it's not going to be very predictive. So the to resolve this issue, the key aspect, and that's regardless of our specific construction, that's true for any attempt to explain entropy in terms of soft hair excitations. So for any such attempt, you have to find a controlled way to get a cutoff on the soft hair spectrum. And the way that we do this is by translating two data from the asymptotic observer into the near horizon region in a controlled way. And these two data are the asymptotic value of mass and angular momentum of the black hole. And physically, it makes sense that you need this information because, well, we're interested in the entropy of a black hole that, for an asymptotic observer, would seem like a state with a certain mass and angular momentum. So it makes sense that we have to provide this input also in the near horizon description. Okay, and well, and the sort of opposite obstacle is too little information discussed in Mary's papers 23 years ago. So you can show that for the asymptotic observer, there's essentially no relevant information from the soft hair states. So you can sort of factorize your S matrix and formulate everything in terms of stressed states, where the soft hair essentially doesn't play any role. And then, well, it's not easy to see how something like information loss problem of black holes can be resolved by putting soft hair on the black hole. So, well, possible resolution to this is to not consider an asymptotic observer, but a near horizon observer. I think for an asymptotic observer, it's never going to be simple to decipher the microstates. It's, on general grounds, you expect it's a very hard experiment that you have to perform. You have to measure some 10 to the 79 point function if you want to really learn about the microstate of an astrophysical black hole. But okay, so let's just not consider an asymptotic observer, but some near horizon observer, and hope that this may be enough to simplify things so that we can resolve this issue. And well, together with my colleagues in Tehran, we came up with a proposal that they like to call fluff proposal. So the idea is that the semi-classical PDZ black hole, the microstates are generated as near horizon descendants of the vacuum. So again, we introduced the usual highest weight vacuum defined by the highest weight conditions. And the black hole microstates are explicitly given by all possible descendants of the vacuum subject to a spectral constraint that depends on the black hole mass M and the angular momentum J as measured by an asymptotic observer. So this spectral constraint is what provides the cutoff on the soft hair spectrum. So we inject this information about mass M and angular momentum J as measured by an asymptotic observer into this near horizon theory. And this is then, this provides a complete list of all the black hole microstates. Again, for black holes that are sufficiently large, so M plus J and M minus J have to be large numbers. And well, explicitly, the spectral constraints takes the following form. So the sum over all these integers is given by M plus minus J times C over 2. Of course, we're implicitly assuming that this number here is an integer number, but since we have to work in the large C limit and also in the large M plus J and M minus J limit, it's not much of an assumption.
So C
is here the Brownian all-central charge.
But you're in ADS now?
I've been in ADS the whole time.
Whatever you were saying before is near horizon.
The near horizon limit doesn't depend on ADS, but the example that I'm considering is ADS, because otherwise I don't have black holes in three dimensions. If I consider flat space, I do get solutions with the horizon, but I don't have black holes. So
where
just
is the condition?
I'm going to explain. Well, I'm going to mention it. Let's see. I'm not going through all the details. So this spectral constraint is derived from three other assumptions. And I have varying degrees of bad conscience about each of them. So the first one, I don't have much of a bad conscience. So the first assumption is that we assume that the central charge is quantized in the integers. Since we have to work in the semi-classical limit, G is very small, so C is very large. So assuming it's an integer, I don't think it's a big deal. Moreover, you need some quantization of Newton's constant anyway, because if you had a continuum of possible values for the central charge, you would get in conflict with some logic of C theorem. The second condition is a bit less obvious, but we need it. So we assume that conical deficit angles are quantized in integers over C. And it's a bit technical why we need it, and I'm happy to elaborate on this afterwards or in the question session. But it's another assumption that we have to impose by hand.
Does this effectively mean the mass? Is this quantization of mass? What do you mean by quantization
of conical deficit angles? So that means so when you consider particles in ADS3, they generate a conical deficit.
So that's the mass.
And yeah, exactly. And then that's right. We are quantizing, but in integers over C. So if C is very large, it's not that much of an assumption, because then it's, well, almost not quantized. But for any finite, even if it's arbitrary large value of C, we have to assume it's integers over C. And that's crucial, because otherwise our construction doesn't work. There's at least one example where this is realized. That's in the Malacena mouse discussion of the D1, D5 system. They actually do find such a quantization. So here we're just lifting this to sort of a Bohr type of quantization condition without justifying it from first principles. And then we use this and see what are the consequences of these conditions. And the third one is, we call called it black hole particle correspondence. So the statement that we can think of a black hole as a gas of coherent states of particles on ADS3. So if you act with just one such creation operator on the vacuum, then you generate a state that you can interpret geometrically. It's just a particle in ADS. But if you act with arbitrary numbers of discretion and annihilation operators, you get a state, but I don't know what the precise geometric interpretation is, so we just use these words. It's a gas of coherent states of particles on ADS3. Okay, and with these assumptions, you can derive this spectral constraint. And now that we have, so now I claim this is a complete list of semi-classical microstates of PTZ, so we can at least check if this claim is true by counting them.
Can you give an idea?
How to derive this, you mean? Well, from these conditions. So,
how do you relate NI to the NICE? NI is yourself the area
Yeah, so we have to relate. So, M plus J and M minus J are the L0 and L0 bar eigenvalues in the asymptotic description. So we somehow have to relate the asymptotic Virasoro generators to some Virasoro generators in the near horizon picture. That's what this black hole particle correspondence is about. And so we do this by so we look at the we split the Virasoro Hilbert space into the black hole part and the asymptotic one, and the black hole part and into conical deficits and global ADS.
So do you interpret this as a deficit?
If it was a single one, then yes. So as I said, I don't know a geometric interpretation of states when I act with more than one of the J's on zero. If I act just with one of them, then it is literally just a geometry that describes a conical deficit. But okay, there are many details that I'm skipping. I'm happy to elaborate on them, but I think it's better if I do this afterwards because it's a longer story. And I wanted to, well, of course it's important because this is sort of the main input to derive this, but it's a somewhat lengthy derivation. So let me move on and discuss the consequences of this. So this is the list of PTZ microstates, and let's now count them. And it's a simple combinatorial problem. How many ways are there to decompose large positive integer, C over 2, M plus minus J, into sum of positive integers, and that problem was solved more than 100 years ago by Hardy and Ramanujan, and the asymptotic expression for the number of such partitions in the limit of large integers is given by that expression here. And to get the entropy, then we just use Boltzmann's formula. So the entropy is the logarithm of the partitions of C over 2 m plus j plus the logarithm of partitions of C over 2 m minus j. And when you insert, when you apply this Hardy-Ramanujan formula with these values for the integers, you reproduce precisely the Hardy formula, which is equivalent to our near horizon entropy formula and in turn equivalent to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. So the fact that the square root drops out here comes from the relation between our near horizon currents and the asymptotic Virasoro currents through a twisted Chukwara construction. You can also, so you get not only the leading order term, you also get log corrections from this polynomial prefactor, and the numerical coefficient in front of the log term turns out to be minus 2. And if you're familiar with the log corrections for PTZ, then that number probably sounds incorrect because you may remember minus 3 over 2 instead of minus 2. but which number you have here depends on the precise ensemble that you're using. So this -3/2 is only true in the microcanonical ensemble. And we're using a slightly different ensemble, some mixed ensemble. And if you carefully take into account the Jacobian that you get by mapping our ensemble to the microcanonical, then you find that indeed you should get -2. So this set of microstates works to the extent that it gives the correct leading order Bekenstein-Honka entropy and the correct log corrections suitable for the ensemble.
If you had a different algebra, what would have changed?
A different near horizon symmetry algebra? But I mean, like what type of algebra? So yeah, I mean, the log corrections definitely would change because that depends on what type of ensemble you use, and the ensemble is specified by what type of boundary conditions you use. The Bekenstein-Hawking entropy that always has to come out correct because the state space shouldn't care about how you slice it. So as long as you have a consistent set of boundary conditions. Well, I'm not sure you're going to be able to write down a complete list of semi-classical microstates, but at least macroscopically, you will always get the correct entropy for any set of boundary conditions that includes black holes as part of the spectrum. But I don't think there's any proposal, for instance, for Virasoro, for a complete list of these microstates. You can count them by cardiology, but that doesn't tell you what the microstates are precisely. So here we're not doing a sort of classical counting in the Cardi sense, where we just write down the entropy based on symmetries. We're really explicitly writing down a complete list of all the semi-classical microstates. So that's one step further than what you usually do. You can also do a classical Cardi type of counting, and that also works, but that's sort of less specific than explicitly writing down all the microstates. Is it counting something? It's telling you what ensemble you're using. So I guess it would be counting something, but there's at least one ensemble where this factor is actually zero, namely, I think it's the canonical ensemble. So in that ensemble, you don't actually have any log corrections. So I think at least for BTZ, the prefactor here is purely a choice of ensemble. It tells you what ensemble you're using, but I don't think there's... Yeah, I don't. Since in the canonical ensemble the factor is zero, I don't think this counts something specific. Okay, so let me now address some generalizations. So first of all, what about the near-horizon boundary conditions that we started with? That turns out to work in any dimension and for any local geometry, and also for any reasonable theory with metric. Well, I'm not sure it's true for any reasonable theory, but the theories we checked it for are Einstein gravity with or without, cosmology constant, high spin gravity, and various massive gravity theories. If your favorite theory with metric is missing here, then let me know and we may check it. And for any type of non-extremal horizon. Yes?
Why can't you do it? I'm
not sure we can't, it's just we haven't. We have started with a near horizon expansion where we explicitly assumed that surface gravity is non-zero, and that just eliminates extremal horizons. Now, the way we set up the boundary conditions, there's no smooth limit to extremal horizons. My expectation is that when you set up the problem from scratch for extremal horizons, you would get a very similar story, but essentially one chiral half of it. So instead of two U1 current algebras, I expect you get just one U1 current algebra.
So the problem is you don't know the right boundary conditions.
That's right. Yes, that's right. We don't know the right boundary conditions, and I don't think there's a smooth limit of our boundary conditions to extremal ones. Or at least I don't know if there's a smooth limit. The naive limit that we tried certainly doesn't exist. But there might be, maybe you have to rescale things in a certain way and then the limit exists.
Is it because in the extremal case, when the constant time surfaces the horizon proceeds to infinity, is that the problem?
Maybe that's one way of looking at it. But I would expect that there are boundary conditions where you can set up a similar story, and my expectation is you get one Karo half of what we find in three dimensions. But this is to be checked. But you know, we are sort of more interested in generic black holes. There's a lot of literature on extreme black holes, of course, and eventually it would be interesting to make contact with it. But we're happy if the story actually works for non-extremal black holes. Okay, so what about soft Heisenberg here? That works for Einstein gravity, high derivative gravity, and high spin gravity in three dimensions, and also for Einstein gravity in higher dimensions. The entropy formula, again, works for all these theories here. I've given you, as an example, Schwarzschild, how it looks like there. So you have some Heisenberg Poisson brackets between spherical harmonics of error-preserving shear deformations and spherical harmonics of near-horizon supertranslations. And the role of Planck's constant is played basically by 1 over 4g. Microstate counting, I have no idea if it works more generally. It may work more generally based on near-horizon symmetries, but we don't know. And the semi-classical microstates, well, that's even less clear. So it might work more generally, but so far we checked it only for the BD-set black hole. And one way or another, if you want to implement this philosophy, you need some Bohr type of rules, and they are not very well understood. I mean, we impose them in an ad hoc way, and even though we have some arguments why we believe it's nice to impose them, the main argument is, the main reason why I believe they're nice is because they give the same result. They give the correct result. Okay, so what are the takeaway messages? Near-horizon boundary conditions can be useful for black hole description. In the same way that in electrodynamics, you know, when you want to describe something like a electrochem or a conductor, you don't necessarily need to know everything about the microstructure of the material. You can sort of cut out the material and place their suitable boundary conditions that capture the physical properties of the material. So you can try to think about black holes in the same way. We don't necessarily have to understand all the microscopic details. We capture them by imposing suitable boundary conditions. Soft Heisenberg has a generic consequence of our specific type of boundary conditions. The entropy formula in the semi-classical limit is universal and depends only on semi-classical input. And okay, microstate construction may work at least for BD set. And here's some open issues. I confine myself to three. The question that Raphael was asking, what about software for extreme black holes and also for cosmologies? Particularly, is there some relation to adiabatic modes in cosmologies? Maybe, you know, the soft excitations on horizons are nothing else but the adiabatic modes. More difficult questions are dynamical ones, such as black hole evaporation. Now, if we want to address these questions, then for sure we have to extend our boundary conditions. We have to relax them further. We have to allow for non-integrable charges so that you have something like bond inuse. At the moment, we don't do this. And finally, of course, it's always a dream to come up with some microstate construction for non-extremal core black holes. Okay, so let me stop here and thank you for your attention.
Nobody had so many questions. Maybe one quick one to finish off. Okay, so it seems everything is answered, but Daniel will be here until tomorrow. Until
sure.
Two.
That's
so
fine.
You can go to his office and ask more questions. So
okay.
Let's bring it again.
Thank you.